ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the early 1990s, five of the seven High Court justices were Catholic. One of them was Sir Gerard Brennan, most famous for his Mabo decision granting native title to Indigenous Australians. Did his religion influence his decisions as a judge? His son, Jesuit priest Frank Brennan, has released a collection of his father's writing. It gives an extraordinary insight into a jurist who helped shape Australian law.
I think his Catholicism helped to consolidate his views as to what he thought were the contemporary and abiding values of the Australian community. And from that, he was able to derive principles which assisted him as a judge to do three different things. One was to interpret the Constitution. Well, I don't think his Catholic faith really had anything to do with that. The second was interpreting statutes. And where there was any ambiguity, yes, he had a strong preference for the human dignity of the person and fundamental human rights. And I think he saw that as consistent with his Christian faith and the Catholic tradition. Most fundamentally, as a High Court judge developing what we call the common law, and as we saw in something like the Mabo decision, that there was the capacity to develop the law consistent with what he saw as fundamental human values.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what's the best example, Frank, of where Sir Gerard brought that sensibility for Catholic social justice to bear? What's the best example from the bench?
The best example is probably his dissenting opinion in a case called Marion, which was in relation to the non-therapeutic sterilisation of a girl with disabilities. The majority of the bench said that a court and the state was able to order and authorise such a sterilisation, for example. Whereas he, relying upon the fundamental human dignity of every person, including someone suffering acute disabilities, he said that there should be no interference with their bodily integrity unless it was something to which they were capable of consenting, or unless it was something which was absolutely essential for the respect of their human dignity.
The Mabo case of 1992 overturned the idea of Australia as terra nullius, of Australia as an unoccupied land. It was a view that had essentially erased the first Australians. Now, your father was the driver in that decision to recognise previous Indigenous ownership. But his Catholicism, and I think that of several other judges, including Bill Dean, became a bit of an issue afterwards, didn't it? How?
There was a bit of media speculation about that, Andrew, because it was pointed out that Mabo was a 6-1 decision, and yes, the only member of the High Court who had no Catholic education whatever was the sole dissentient, Darrell Dawson. But I think it is a long bow to say that it was the Catholic education of the other six judges that pointed them in the direction of the development of the common law. And the other thing to say, of course, is that, yes, my father's was the main opinion in that he was more restrictive than three of the other judges were. And so, in the end, he spoke for what was the majority of the court. Definitely with my father, what was absolutely essential for him in the profession of his religious faith was to be absolutely true and faithful to the judicial oath. And the question then became, as a High Court judge, how and what are the limits in the development of the common law?
I'm referring, though, to some comments made by Hugh Morgan, a mining executive, afterwards. And I mean, Hugh Morgan, not a reflection on Hugh Morgan, but I mean, he didn't agree, emphatically did not agree with what your father and six of the other judges had decided. And he basically sort of implied that they were Catholic lefties. I mean, didn't he?
Well, he did. And he went even further with the preposterous idea that somehow this had been all worked out over a cleansing ale at a barbecue between my father and me, which, of course, was absolutely ludicrous. He overlooked the fact that 4 years before, when the litigation commenced, my father, being a scrupulous judge of the utmost integrity, had made a declaration from the bench that he had a son who was involved in the pastoral ministry to these people and had some involvement in agitating their rights in the political forum. No one, quite rightly, expressed any objection 4 years before, and no one should have expressed any objection thereafter.
Yeah, but I was going to say, Frank, there's a bit of a subtext there because, look, your love and admiration for your father is abundantly clear in this book, but I did get the impression that you got a little stroppy with him over what he said from the bench. But I did get the feeling that you thought, gee, Dad, you went a bit far there. You didn't need to say all this.
Well, I had no idea at the time that he'd said this. It was only later when the lawyers pointed it out to me. And I did think it was an undue excess of judicial scrupulosity, but that was him.
You mean he was being too scrupulous, you were saying?
I thought so. Anyway, he knew how to conduct himself as a High Court judge, and with the later attack by Hugh Morgan, even I was grateful that he had made those remarks from the bench.
Yeah. Your father's father, your paternal grandfather, was a judge as well, but he was also a Labor politician in Queensland in the early 1900s. Did that shape Sir Gerard Brennan as much as his Catholicism, his father being a Labor politician?
It was a big influence on him, not so much because he was a Labor politician, but having been a Labor politician and having been mainly a solicitor and not long a barrister when he was appointed to the Supreme Court of Queensland, he was one who was never accepted by the judicial establishment. So when my father came to the bar in Brisbane, he was one who was starting well behind the eight ball. And he knew that the legal establishment had no time for his father, and they gave him a pretty hard time in his early years.
Yeah, the reason I ask that, though, about whether the Labor thinking, the Labor philosophy had influenced Sir Gerard, was because in this collection of speeches and articles, it's pretty clear that in addition to Sir Gerard's loathing of things like racism, and his support for the asylum seeker, the stranger in biblical terms, he really seems to hate what he calls obscene wealth and extravagant lifestyles.
Well, his view was, if you looked at his own personal life, he gave most of his money away. And yes, he was not one who was given to a lavish lifestyle. And he did think that there was in Australia an increasing gap between the rich and the poor. And for that, he felt very keenly. But he knew that as a judge, there was very little he could do about that. He was only a judge judging the cases that came before him. But when he was in a position, as he often was, to give talks to Catholic social service groups or to Christian lawyers or whatever, he would take every opportunity to urge people to come back to the basics of the gospel and to ensure that there was equality for all and to ensure that there was not too much of a lavish lifestyle.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report on Radio National with me, Andrew West, we're speaking with Jesuit priest and lawyer Father Frank Brennan. He's put together a collection of speeches and letters from his late father, Sir Gerard Brennan, who was the former Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia. Frank, Sir Gerard said in relation to sort of extreme wealth and obscene wealth, he said, look, he didn't think the solution was in Soviet-style redistribution, but basically a sort of a combination of prudent limits by government, but also personal disposition to generosity by the rich. I'm wondering, though, whether did he have too much faith in humankind if he thought that some of our problems could be solved simply by people being more generous?
No, well, I think for him it was always a combination of being practical, like his lifelong membership of the Vincent de Paul Society. And yes, he used to do his Vincent de Paul rounds even when he was a High Court judge. but also for him, it was that he was a judge. He was not a member of the federal parliament or a state parliament. He was not in a position to be shaping big social policy, but definitely as an individual citizen, whenever he had the opportunity, he would express his view that he thought that we were becoming too secular and too wealthy a society.
Yeah, there's a phrase that comes through constantly in his speeches: justice according to the law. Now, am I right, though, Frank, in thinking that Sir Gerard was expressing a bit of a frustration here in the sense that, look, I see great injustice. I'm a judge, though. I'm hemmed in by law. I'm duty-bound to accept its strictures. But I'm going to use that law as far as it will take me? I mean, because I'm going back to a speech he made, I think, in 1971, where he said the law could be used to nudge society in a certain way. Was he frustrated about the limits of his job as a judge?
No, I don't think so. I think that, I mean, the clearest instance, Andrew, is if you compare his majority judgment in Mabo, where he found for native title for Aboriginal people, and his dissenting judgment some years later in the Wick case, where he said, as a judge, I can't find my way clear to develop the common law consistently so as to recognise the rights of the Aboriginal people in an ongoing fashion on a pastoral lease where someone else has rights and interests in that land. Now, as I point out in the book, back 20 years before, he'd been the barrister for the Aboriginal people in the Woodward Royal Commission, where he'd argued very passionately for the ongoing recognition of the rights of the Aboriginal people to be retained on pastoral leases. So he was in no doubt as to what the moral position should be, but equally he was in no doubt about the limits of the judicial office. And in his dissent in Wick, he said, there is here a moral shortcoming. This is a task for Parliament. It's not a task for the judges. Yeah. So I think there was a real consistency there.
Yeah. Is that what he meant when he made a speech? I think it was 2001 where he said, look, the law is an imperfect instrument that sometimes can produce injustice. What did he mean by that?
What he meant by that was that Parliament, in making legislation, can make legislation which is demonstrably unjust. And if it does, judges who have sworn their oath are not in a position to simply strike down a law on the basis that they think it unjust. Yes, they can go to great lengths to say that there might be ambiguities in the statute, and if there be, that the ambiguity be resolved in favour of human liberty and human dignity. But if there's no ambiguity, there may still be an injustice. And I think you saw that clearly with some of his judgments in the refugee and asylum cases, that yes, Parliament was doing things and authorising government to do things, like even burning the boats of asylum seekers, where you could see in the judgments that there was horror at this prospect, but that there was very little that the judges could do to reverse what Parliament was instituting.
Were he and other judges evincing that horror at what was happening in their judgments? Were they effectively sending, though, a dissenting message saying, look, we can't change the law, but you, the public, can, by whom you choose as lawmakers, by whom you choose as politicians?
Absolutely. And I think that also fed into the idea that my father had, that this notion of contemporary community values from which you could derive the principles which then allow you to determine what is the shape of the common law or the interpretation of the statute, but acknowledging that there may be a change in community values and that there may be a prospect that the nation is not quite the great virtuous nation that he hoped that it was or that he'd been brought up in. One of his favourite phrases was one he inherited from the great elderly judge Sir Reginald Smithers, who used to speak of the attributes of a free and confident nation. Now, Dad spent all his judicial life confident and hoping that he was part of a free and confident nation. But at times there were things like the treatment of asylum seekers that had many of us doubting that.
You mentioned his, invoking Sir Reginald Smithers. I also noticed that, these speeches are fascinating. There is one respect in which he was a great rhetorical recycler, because he seemed to like St. Basil the Great, his quote about the coat that you do not wear. That gets quite a workout in many speeches, Frank.
It does. And he had a few of those favourites, but also, as you'll see from the speeches, you having looked at them closely, that he was quite influenced by Catholic social teaching, particularly the encyclicals of Pope John Paul II. He had a great respect for John Paul II's intellectual finesse and for his rugged commitment to social justice. Yeah. And that was at a time when Dad was in his prime, both as a judge and as one who was giving speeches of this sort around the country.
Now, Sir Gerard did believe in the Catholic teaching about the sanctity of life from conception to natural death. So he was opposed to abortion and the death penalty. How does a jurist such as Sir Gerard handle a situation where the law permits abortion and, as you've got in some states of the United States, requires the death penalty? How does a jurist with his sensibility wrestle with that? I don't know if an abortion case ever came before him.
Well, there are two issues you've raised, the death penalty and abortion. First, death penalty. He was introduced to the death penalty very early in life, Andrew, at the age of 21. He was associate to Justice Townley on the Japanese War Crimes Tribunal in Manus Island. He heard the death penalty pronounced a number of times. So he was a passionate advocate against the death penalty all his life. So, for example, later in life, when he'd retired from the High Court and he was a judge on the Final Court of Appeal in Hong Kong, he undertook that task, but with the understanding that he would refuse to sit on any capital case. He would have nothing to do with a death penalty case. In relation to abortion, there were a couple of cases that came before the High Court when he was a judge of the court. It was very clear that he regarded all life as dignified and to be sanctified from the moment of conception, but that did not detract from him having to apply the law as it was in the situation before him. It was a clear instance of saying that I have my own personal views on abortion, but the law is the law and the law has to be applied by the judge.
On that same point, there were other speeches where he speaks most speeches where he speaks about the dignity of all people, including the prisoner. I think he said wayward behaviour might mean the deprivation of liberty for a time, but it never means the deprivation of human dignity. I know he didn't serve on the local or district court, but did Sir Gerard ever have to either send someone to jail or uphold a jail sentence?
Well, he had to uphold jail sentences all the time in determining applications for special leave to the High Court and also in determining appeals in the High Court in criminal matters. He was one who was very worried that our society was using prison no longer as a last resort, that imprisonment rates were increasing horrendously, particularly imprisonment rates amongst Indigenous Australians. But to his dying day, he lamented that as a judge, there was very little that he was able to do about that.
Yeah, there's a very newsworthy, controversial part of this book, I should say. 25 years ago, he had an exchange of letters with the late Cardinal George Pell. Now, look, George Pell remains in death, as he was in life, a very divisive figure. We have to acknowledge that. George Pell and your father had a very deep disagreement over... Yeah. And I found this fascinating, over the idea that individual conscience is a primary issue for the Catholic. George Pell basically said, look, church law, which he says embodies the truth, totally trumps conscience. How did your father and George Pell disagree? This is a fundamental difference that these two men had.
They disagreed in that Cardinal Pell had given a speech in which he said that he thought it was time to quietly ditch the idea of the primacy of conscience. So my father then gave the annual Thomas More lecture to the Thomas More Society in Sydney, where he joined issue with that, and he quoted various papal encyclicals in favour of what he took as the approach that the fundamental obligation of every person was to form their conscience, to inform that conscience, and to that conscience be true. And he respectfully put it back to Pell that the idea that you could tell a Christian like Gerard Brennan, don't worry, just follow what the bishops have told you to do, that my father thought that could at times be a path to error. And he quoted, for example, that in the old days, when he was a young man, they were being told that they could not attend the weddings of people in Protestant churches, and that everyone now accepted that that was absolutely ludicrous. And so my father was suggesting that it's absolutely essential that we insist on the primacy of the conscience of the individual person. It has to be conceded to Cardinal Pell that there were some things said by John Paul II which tended to indicate that, look, don't worry, there's a shortcut to following your conscience. It's just doing what the bishops have told you. But our late Pope Francis made it very clear many times over that that sort of idea is no longer Catholic teaching. And Pope Francis made it very clear that even in very adverse circumstances, people could make conscientious decisions which don't match completely with church law. So I think on that one, over time, my father had the better of the argument.
Yeah. What about this point, though? Because George Pell did say in a letter that he tries to keep civil, but he appears to be stroppy. He basically says, look, I'm surprised that a judge who has spent a lifetime properly enforcing the law should now espouse the idea of conscience and the primacy of conscience and oppose an authoritarian demand for conformity. I mean, George Pell seemed to be saying, but you're a judge. Your whole job is to demand conformity. What did your father say in reply to that?
What he said in reply to that was that you, George Pell, a bishop, may have to exercise a sanction over somebody, but that doesn't mean that in applying the sanction that the person has acted against their conscience. They may well be acting truly in accordance with their conscience, but there may still be a need to exercise a sanction upon them for the good of the society, for the good of the community. So my father saw no contradiction there whatsoever.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National with me, Andrew West, we're discussing a new volume of speeches and statements by the former High Court Judge Sir Gerard Brennan, put together by his son, Jesuit priest and lawyer, Father Frank Brennan. Frank, just as we wind up, there's an interesting new or well, maybe it's a renewed legal doctrine in the United States called Catholic integralism. Now, its champion is a very respected Harvard law professor, Adrian Vermeul. I would put him at the, let us say, the edge of the mainstream. He's not a fringe figure. But in essence, yes, his doctrine says the world would be a much better place if the law and the government was built to reflect the teaching of the Catholic Church. How did the kind of Catholic-influenced legal thinking of your father, Gerard Brennan, differ from this so-called Catholic integralism, which seems to be having a sort of a new moment?
I think very fundamentally, Andrew, because my father was very grateful that we didn't live in a theocracy, and he was very grateful that we lived under a system of law with separation of powers so different from the United States. I mean, that idea that Harvard academic has put forward could only be born out of a constitutional system where it's unelected judges who are the ones who are making the key moral decisions or decisions about key social philosophies, whereas under the Australian system, all of that is left to Parliament, and more fundamentally, there is a very clear definition of the role of the judge, particularly in relation to the state. The other point to make is that my father, early in his judicial life, was the first president of what's called the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and the Administrative Review Council, and he had to spend a lot of his time trying to resolve how far a tribunal could go in reversing the policy set down by a minister, and he set very firm constraints on that. Now, all of that is quite inconsistent with that idea of integralism, where basically it's being argued that the all-knowing Catholic judge might be the one who could visit upon the public something which was seen to be a good moral order. My father had no time for that whatever.
Can you ever recall a moment when Sir Gerard Brennan ever thought, ever really wrestled? I mean, I'm sure he wrestled all the time with the decisions he had to make. I mean, he was a High Court judge, and for three years he was the chief judge of the High Court. He was Australia's highest judicial officer. But I'm just wondering, was there ever a moment when he thought that his career as a judge just could conflict too much with his devotion to Catholic social justice?
No, I think for him, the fact that we lived under the Australian constitutional system, thereby avoiding so much of those American complexities, I think that on balance, he found it a fairly easy task. I remember, for example, he preached at the ecumenical service in the Lutheran Church in Canberra for the beginning of the legal year in 1992, when the argument in Mabo had been heard and the judgment was reserved. You can see him wrestling with what are the limits on what the Christian can do in the application and the development of the law. And he had a very fine phrase in that, where he said that your Christian belief is not a solvent for the obligation that you have undertaken by oath to administer justice according to law. And that for him was the fundamental thing, that as a committed Christian, one commits before God to administer justice according to law, and therefore one is committed within the limits of what the law can allow in terms of development without fracturing what he called the skeleton of principle.
Wasn't there a bit of chatter in the late 1990s, when Australia looked like it may choose a republic, that Sir Gerard Brennan might have been the first president?
Or there may have been, but as we used to joke in the family, anyone who said that didn't know my mother. There was no way my mother would have taken on the role as the wife of the president. But definitely, in seriousness, my father was very committed to the idea of a republic and to a republic where the president was not elected by the people. And he joined with Sir Zelman Cowan and Sir Anthony Mason, three knights of the realm, but two ex-chief justices and one ex-governor general, to argue very convincingly that there were no legal shortfalls in what was being proposed. But that was never to be, and yes, he was not to be president.
It's been terrific to speak with you. We've been speaking with Father Frank Brennan about his two-volume collection of the articles and speeches by his father, the late Sir Gerard Brennan, who was the Chief Justice of Australia's High Court. It's published by Connor Court Publishing. Thank you very much for coming back to the Religion and Ethics Report, Frank.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to be with you.
Think bigger about the world we live in. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.